when I found out I was going to be guest this year, I made sure I came to the talks last year to hear what they were like, so I had some idea, and I thought, oh my God, I'm never living up to the great speeches that were there last year. But what I noticed that was common among all of them is they were uplifting, positive speeches. And then we've now had three more uplifting and positive speeches. So naturally, I decided I had to be a curmudgeon, which, having recently retired as a professor and being 65, I get to do legally, apparently, along with the Hawaiian shirt. It comes with the age and retirement. But I have repeated the joke many times that becoming an editor, I took early retirement to become a full-time editor, is much like having graduate students forever. The difference is I get to be way ruder to the authors than I get to be to graduate students, so I love my job. But I'd like, having the perspective of being a professor and now retired, to look back and talk about those experiences for a minute as they relate to writing. Because I spent the last 25 years or so working in an education faculty teaching mostly English majors and social studies teachers, or about to become English and social studies teachers, and I've seen a few trends there which I'll share with you. Now, the curmudgeon part is that every generation thinks, you know, these young kids today are useless. So I will follow that theme, but it ends, I hope to end on a more optimistic note when I get to the end here, so bear with me. When I first started teaching and I had my first class of English majors, I remember distinctly saying to them, okay, for this weekend we're not going to have an assignment because I know you'll all want to do the three-day novel contest. And there was complete silence in the room because they had no idea what the hell I was talking about, right? So I said, well, how many of you are doing the three-day novel contest? And none of them were. I said, oh, you don't know about the contest. It's a great contest. Let me tell you about it. And then I said, okay, so you're not doing a contest. So what have you written? And no one in that room had written anything and got it published. There were only two students out of 45 who had a few things in their bottom drawer that no one would ever see. And I kind of lost it and exploded at them and said, how can you be English teachers and pretend to teach people how to write when you're not doing it yourself? You are a fraud. And they all conceded that what they were readers, people who fell in love with reading, and somewhere along the road in high school, someone said, you don't have to stop high school or reading. You can get a degree in reading. It's called an English degree. So they did that. And then at some point, they realized they were going to starve because after university, nobody pays you to read. So they decided to become English teachers, right? So I spent a lot of time trying to make English majors guilty about not writing, and I succeeded in getting a few of them to write over the years. But the trend that I've noticed over the 25 years that I was teaching those English majors is that they stopped being readers as well. I would start the class saying, what are you reading now every year? And they'd say Victor Hugo and Shakespeare and in Hamilton books, right? They would read modern literature, old literature. Okay, maybe not 25 years ago. But
there was that first book.
They would read some really good contemporary fiction, but the classics. Now, when I ask them, what are you reading, they will give me the list of assigned readings in their other courses. And that's pretty much it. And I say, no, what are you reading for pleasure? I read a book a couple of years ago, I think, right? I don't remember the title. This terrifies me because these are the next generation of English teachers. If they're not reading, let alone writing, we are doomed, people. Things are bad. That's a curmudgeon part. It gets better from here. Well, no, I guess one more negative part. Sorry. I have found also in my courses, when I started teaching that class, several different courses, I would have a book of readings that were based on sociological, philosophical, academic, scholarly works from refereed journals. And they would struggle a bit, even though they were English majors, not quite as much as the math majors would struggle with the articles, but they'd find it tough going, and then they'd say, well, that was really profound, so I guess it was worth the effort. But over the last 25 years, I noticed there was less depth to the reading, and I discovered that, in fact, they weren't reading the articles. And over the years, because a good teacher realizes you don't start where students should be, you start where they are, I had to dumb down my textbooks. So by the end, almost the end, I was, instead of using articles by Giroux and Michael Apple, I was using articles out of Maclean's magazine as discussion starters. And then I realized they weren't reading the Maclean's articles. Throughout, I had kept one academic article that had been written by my dean, not just because it was my dean, but she had written the article specifically for my class. So it was written targeted at university students, so it shouldn't have been difficult. It was a topic that was near and dear to their hearts, and yet when they read the article put in with these other discussion starters, they'd say, that's the hardest thing I've had to read in the last 3 years. And they say, you know, in the end we understood it, but why did she have to make it such a long and difficult article? Why couldn't she just have given us the bullet points? I actually had someone say, you know, there's a web page that covers some of that stuff. Why did we have to read the article? These are English teachers. So I fear for the next generation. Now, I am a bit of a jerk. I don't know if you know me well, but I would say to the students at the start of every class, have you done the readings for today? And they would all say, yes, yes, we have done the readings. And it would become patently obvious from the discussion that they had not. So one year, as I put together the book of readings, I took one of the articles, admittedly one of the more boring ones. The article is about students who are physically there but haven't actually participated in the class. They're not engaged in what you should do about them. They, of course, think that means their students. I'm thinking them. And in the middle of that article, I inserted a paragraph where I said, excuse me, this isn't the author, this is Robert. I'd like to thank you for reading this far because I know you have other courses and I know you're under a lot of stress because student teaching's coming up. And I know that you have other things you'd rather be doing than reading. So if you're reading this, I'd like to give you a 5% bonus. So email me the code phrase, I'd like fries with that, and I will give you a 5% bonus. Out of that first year class of 45, I got 3 emails, right? Students who in their email said, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen, right? And then we went to class and I said, how many of you read the article? Yes, we've all read the articles. And 3 students collapse into laughter. Well, I say, really, it was odd that you didn't take, you know, advantage of the 5% bonus then. And they're, what? But realizing that they weren't even reading these simple articles from discussion-starting magazines, I simply struck the reader from my course the last 3 years. I didn't make them read anything, for which they were eternally grateful, but which made me very sad. So we would have discussions, and I would lecture more because I am a brilliant lecturer, but I knew that they would not take in content that was written. The best I could do is go for maybe a radio broadcast of my voice. The flip side, here it gets a little better. While it's terrifying to think of English teachers who do not read and do not write, the corollary is they're much better at visual content than the previous generation. So a colleague of mine brought that to my attention. She's a history teacher who had used the same photos in her class for years. And when she started 25 years ago, she put up a picture of a schoolroom from, you know, 1812 and say, what can we see in this picture? And after half an hour of coaching, one of them might say, is that a cross? Does that mean this might be a Catholic school? And, you know, like, duh. So from that, we went to kids who would dissect the visuals with such perception that they would see things that she had missed after using the same picture for 25 years. Another example comes to mind. Media literacy, we've always had it as part of the Alberta curriculum. My students know it's the most boring topic in the world because they take it in grade 6 and again in grade 9 and again in grade 12. So what happens is they write an assignment in grade 6, recycle it in grade 9, comes in grade 12. It would be, I'd do media literacy in my class and I'd get the same grade 6 paper. Because however it was repackaged by the publisher, basically media literacy until recently had been about audience watching movies, watching TV, watching video games, and dissecting it. Critical viewing is what it's called in the curriculum. I had the privilege of writing the introduction to the first textbook that said media literacy should be about producing media. And it's a book about how you get kids to make videos about their lives, about talking back to big media. And it was written by a guy who lives in Toronto and works with disadvantaged kids who kept seeing their neighborhood portrayed as gangland, as horrible, as a terrible place to be. And they went out and made videos that talked back to that message and say, no, actually, ours is a vibrant, wonderful community that you don't understand, that you refuse to portray in the media because you're racist, classist jerks. So that's true media literacy. So we've maybe lost some reading, lost some writing, but we've made gains in the media that counts in this century that is maybe positive, and we shouldn't completely despair. That's half of the balance. The other half is, I don't think that kids are illiterate just because their English teachers are. My daughter and her friends, thanks to the video Les Mis, have gotten into Les Mis, and so when I see my daughter reading Victor Hugo, that makes me happy. When I realize it's not just my daughter, because she is special and brilliant, obviously, her entire peer group is carrying that book around, I was quite pleased and had, again, hope for the next generation. But then my daughter showed me something I didn't know about, which was fan fiction. I'd heard of fan fiction because back in the day, I bought a first copy of Mirror Mirror, the first Star Trek fan fiction, right? I hadn't quite understood what the internet had done to fan fiction. My daughter reads hundreds of Victor Hugo Les Mis casts replaced into modern high school romance, right? There are thousands of Victor Hugo fan fictions, right? Let me tell you, that's some of the most literate writing I have ever seen. To think that these are high school and university students, it's mind-boggling. But when you think of an audience reading Victor Hugo and then writing Victor Hugo, who the hell needs English teachers? Fan fiction is fantastic. Admittedly, some of the stuff out there is atrocious, but it's kids actually trying to write for an audience. I've been trying to do that in my classroom since I started. Writing for me, that's no good, right? Every kid will tell you, who knows what I'm going to get on this assignment? It's this idiosyncratic idiot who could mark me for who knows what reason, right? A lot of it just seems mysterious. And this guy told me to have longer sentences, that guy told me the opposite. I don't know what it means. An audience of one is of no use if you're trying to learn how to write. But fan fiction? That's an incredible opportunity to write and get audience feedback and to learn your craft in a way that no English teacher is ever going to get there. So, seeing that, talking to people in Kingston that were doing fan fiction, I started seeing there's an upside. And then if we think about what's happening in our world in terms of publishing, how it's changing, and self-publishing, I'd like to extrapolate that a little bit. So again, if I was doing the curmudgeon thing, the bad news is obvious. I mean, self-publishing, hell, we used to think vanity presses were bad because they'd publish anything. I remember one ad for one letter I saw from a vanity press publisher 20 years ago who said, as long as the sentence starts with a capital and ends with a period, it's good enough to publish, right? They had no idea how bad, because at least those people were trying to be authors, were trying to be good. They were being ripped off by the publishers, but they had maybe no quality control, but at least it was literate, kind of, right? Vanity self-publishing, the depths to which you can go, unimaginable before that. But before I go any further, let me distinguish between vanity self-publishing, which is first draft, unedited, by people who have no intention of learning grammar, right, or actively anti-grammar, versus people who are self-publishing in a serious way, right? I know lots of people who have taken their backlist out of obscurity and published it. Those books were as good as when they came out from the original publisher. I know lots of people who are seriously trying to work hard at learning their craft, getting better every book. I know people who hire freelance editors to make sure the book's as good as it can be. People like Krista Ball, I don't know if she's here this time, one of my current favorite writers, because it's the perfect beach read after I've been reading terrible manuscripts all day, go read her books. They're serious, right? I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the kid who takes the first draft of their first book and thinks it's perfect and puts it online. The interesting thing is they're often anti-grammar to the point they've articulated quite a sophisticated argument, right? And I think it's reaction to bad English teachers. I told my English teachers, don't cover the student's page in red ink. But they don't listen, right? Here's a mistake, here's another mistake. And what the kid gets back is a message of, you can't do this and don't try it again. Right? And enough of that traumatized people to hate English teachers and everything they stand for, which is unfortunately grammar. So I thought, self-publishing, I am going to make a fortune as a freelance editor because every one of those people needs editing. Apparently, needing and wanting editing, two very different categories. So I understand if they get better beta readers. I understand if they, you know, try to get editing and don't always understand that their mom is not the best editor. But what's happened was they said, grammar is imposed on us by English teachers and editors who are trying to justify their own professions and has no part of the real world. Nobody in my audience cares whether there's a dangling preposition at the end of that sentence. So what they do is they put out a beta issue of their book. So here's the first draft. We put it out there, and they wait for however many people read it. And there are enough people out there, trolls, who love to say that you have a dangling preposition or whatever, and write back. And they listen to that feedback, and they rewrite it, and then they put out the official version of the book, right? Instead of for the 99 cents or free for the beta version, the revised version goes out for $5 or whatever, right? So they crowdsource editing. And the argument is, if nobody in the audience complained about page 36 is fine, damn it, and people like me should bloody well shut up about it, right? Reading some of those books, I tell you, no one in that audience cares for the official rules of the English language, right? I still think there's a place for editors and grammar to make things clear, but to an audience that's been traumatized by bullying in their English classes, yeah, they're not going there. Again, I believe you can't teach people until they're ready. I'll wait for them to get there. I think that in spite of the obvious problems with vanity self-publishing, it'll correct itself over time. I think most people want to get better, and some of the feedback will filter in, and slowly they will. So the problem of self-publishing, vanity self-publishing, there's no referee function. There's nobody to say, this book isn't ready yet. There's nobody to say, it's terrible, right? And you just wait until you get a better book. So we see a lot of terrible, terrible books out there. We as authors in this room are terrified of that because it means the market is flooded with thousands and thousands of titles, and it's hard for people to find our titles, which are good, in amongst all of that noise, right? How do you find the signal for the noise? It's hard for me to get people to look at my Five River titles because our logo looks exactly like the fake logo for their fake press that the smarter self-publishers have figured out. You know, just putting out a book without a logo, oh, I know that's a self-publisher, I won't read it, right? Once bitten, twice shy. So they all have fake publishing. My logo looks about like their logo, right? How do they find that we're a legitimate press? So that's a problem for us. But in the long run, I think this is a good news story. Just like fan fiction is teaching kids how to write better than any English teacher, I think self-publishing brings people into the conversation who weren't there before. If we have a million people writing and self-publishing, if only 10% of those get better, that's still 100,000 now competent writers that we didn't have before in the old system. If only 10% of that 100,000 get to be terrific writers, that's still 10,000 more writers than we have. If out of that 10,000, only 10% get to be literary writer, that's 1,000 new Margaret Atwoods that we wouldn't have otherwise. I think that's a good news story, inconvenient though it may be for us as writers right at the moment. The other thing is not having a refereed function has shown us just how restrictive those referees were. The establishment said, even as they said to you and your writers, nobody's going to publish that, right? All of that negativity. There is no limit to what people will buy and read, apparently. My favorite example is taken by T-Rex. Do you know about this? It's a whole genre. Apparently, there is an unserviced market before for dinosaur porn. You didn't know about this, right? There's a big enough audience that the two women writing this who met as roommates in college and did it as a joke but then found there was real money, they put themselves through college writing those books. No publisher at any time in the history of Earth would have published those books, right? But in a more serious vein, somewhat similarly, I'm old enough to remember my author friends being told, I'm sorry, you cannot have a gay character in this book because the non-gay population is larger. We need to hit the largest common denominator. They will not read about a gay character. You have to take it out. We will not read about a black character. They have to change your First Nations character to white. So self-publishing is really part of the reason there's been this recent explosion in LGD, I never get the initials right. Anyway, the gay, lesbian, bi, questioning, all of that stuff. It didn't come in the mainstream first. It came in the self-published, right? The Shades of 50, terrible grammar. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how bad it was, right? It opened up the market to people say, oh, there's money there. Where self-publishing leads, the rest of us can follow, right? And all of those people are learning to write, are part of the conversation. I think that conversation needed to happen. And I think maybe things are better where we learn by writing and reading rather than by sitting and listening to English teachers who don't read or write. How am I doing on time? Am I probably up, right? Getting close? One last observation then. We're all terrified of what self-publishing is doing to publishing in general. But I'd just like to note, Helen Marshall pointed out to me, and I've seen some of this stuff myself, every time there's a new technology for publishing, people pull their hair out and say it's the end of civilization, and that the quality has just gone through the floor. So when printing press came out, there is an outcry about how quality had been completely lost. This new paper you're using, it's not like vellum. It'll never last more than 60 years, right? It'll disintegrate. It's not hand illuminated. It's mass produced. Where's the art in that? And worst of all, if the printer makes an error, that error is reproduced like 1,000 times, whereas a hand scribe will catch those errors and they will self-correct, right? So when the printing press came out, scribes said it's the end of civilization as we know it. An example that I found quite interesting, in my master's thesis, I went out and did a study on the Universal Magazine of Knowledge and Pleasure, which was originally started in 1740 and lasted till 1840. And it was a fascinating magazine because it happened at the cusp of mass literacy. When it was founded in 1740, the only people who could read and write, a few in the church, but mostly it was the aristocracy. And this was a magazine that the aristocracy used to talk to each other about their inventiveness. So Universal Magazine of Knowledge and Pleasure, so the pleasure part, there was some fiction, there was some poetry, there was some literary arts kind of thing, reviews of plays. But it also had all of the science of it. It was the Scientific American of its age. So the first article ever on sign language as a possibility for the deaf. The first article on irrigation appeared in this magazine in 1740. By the end, 1814, we had mass literacy as a real thing. So what happened was, in chasing that larger mass market, the stories at the end were not so much sign language and irrigation. The last issue was Vicar Caught with Choir Boy. I'm not making that up. So there was a transition period where quality was clearly lost. But, you know, over time, it stabilizes and we get a new Scientific American eventually. Similarly, in the 50s, Richard Hogarth complained in his book, The Uses of Literacy, that the invention of the paperback book was destroying the working class and its values, because now books were affordable by the average worker, right? And how that was a terrible, terrible thing. So I think we're in the same situation. Yes, there are a million people writing horrible books. I think that will self-correct, because some of them will get better, and we'll get better at spotting who are the good writers and who are terrible. You know, Goodreads and Amazon reviews, they're getting there, right? They're still problematic. But we'll find more sophisticated ways to find the great books. On the whole, I'm looking forward to a time when books aren't something where this room full of professionals write it for the masses, but books are a conversation between everybody who's a writer and everybody who's a reader. And to give you one last example, Linda Williams, who wrote her series, a 10-book series written over a period of, I don't know, 40 years. From day one, she encouraged fan fiction, even publishing a magazine for kids to write in response to her books. And then she would write books in response to what they were doing. And that produced at least two more novelists that I know of, right, who writing her fan fiction grew up and now are full-time novelists. That community, that dialogue between reader and writer might become the norm, rather than it being something I consume as a reader or produce as a writer. Maybe I'm starting to see this person writes a novel and this one writes a novel to answer it. I think that's awesome, even if it's a bit scary for us. Thank you very much.